Chapter 7. During the Niobe's return to Suez, the usual northerly breezes blew with scarcely a pause. She had to beat up all the way, often tacking two or three times in a watch, and the cry of "all hands about ship" was even more frequent than that for sweepers, seeing that it came by night as well as by day. And by now her bottom was very foul, especially where her copper had been ripped off. This not only caused her to miss stays more often than was agreeable, but it also made her dreadfully slow, a point of some importance in a crowded ship that had relied on getting rid of her Turks at Mubara and on completing her water there. The people were put on short allowance, and the scuttlebutt, which ordinarily stood on deck for anyone to drink from, was now deprived of its dipper. Those who wished to drink had to suck the water up through a dismounted musket barrel. And so that no man could do so wantonly, the barrel was kept in the main top, since only great thirst would make the climb worthwhile in such overwhelming heat. This was felt to be unjust by the Turks, who said that neither their fathers nor their mothers were apes, and that climbing didn't come naturally to them, whatever might be the case with others. The seamen retorted that as the Turks didn't work, and as they fouled the heads so horrid, they had no right to be thirsty. But the argument carried no conviction, and there might have been serious trouble if the Niobe hadn't put into Kosseir, where water was to be had in abundance, although the wells were awkwardly placed for the boats, and the ship had to lie far offshore. It would, in any case, have taken a considerable time to fill all the casks and get them aboard. But now it took longer than usual. In the ordinary course of events, the air over the Red Sea was so extremely humid that the sun didn't burn, but only boiled those exposed to its rays, and the hands went about stripped to the waist, most of them still quite pale after weeks of it. But on a Friday, still another Friday, the breeze came right off the land, the air grew parching dry, biscuit charts and books became crisp against from one watch to the other, and the seamen burnt brick red or purple. An order to the effect that no hands who were not already black, brown or yellow were any longer to be indulged in the liberty of going shirtless came too late, and although Stephen lavished sweet oil on their tender backs, the burns were so deep that it had little effect. Watering was therefore painful as well as slow. And while it was running its tedious course, the Bimbashi, who had never forgiven Jack for having been misled, very carefully and at great length showed him the scene of another of the Royal Navy's failures. The little five-gun fort defending Kosseir Roads, which had been bombarded by 2 32-gun frigates, Daedalus and Fox, for 2 days and a night, when it was in the hands of the French. "They fired 6,000 rounds," said the Bimbashi, writing it down, so that there should be no mistake. 6,000 rounds! But they failed to take the fort, and their attack was repelled with the loss of a gun and, of course, a great many casualties. "Pray tell the Bimbashi how deeply I am obliged to him for his information," said Jack to Stephen, "and how highly I value it as an example of his politeness." This necessarily had to pass through Hassan, a man of delicate breeding who had been uneasy throughout the Bimbashi's account and who now looked uneasier still. Yet Hassan's farewell was as cold as the Bimbashi's when they took leave of Jack in Suez, the Turk to take his men to Ma'an and the Arab to return to his wilderness. "That was an odd way to say goodbye," said Jack, looking after him with a certain regret and some slight shade of indignation. "I always did the civil thing by him. We always got along perfectly well. I can't imagine what made him so chuff." "Can you not?" said Stephen. "Surely it is that he expected you to come down on him for the 750 purses he promised you to bilk the Egyptian. As he saw it, you had fulfilled your part of the bargain, while he was unable to produce a single purse at the moment of parting, let alone several hundred. He felt that you must scorn him, which is enough to make any man stiff and proud. I never agreed to his monstrous proposal for a moment, gave it no countenance whatsoever. Of course you didn't, but he thought you did, which is what matters. He's not all a bad horse, however. I spent much of the forenoon with him while you were breaming the ship, together with a French-speaking Coptic physician he'd known since his childhood, a gentleman who will act for us if we have any further dealings with the Egyptian governor. A gentleman, moreover, with wide connections among the Greek and Armenian merchants of these parts, and an insatiable appetite for information. Will I call for another pot of this admirable sherbet, the only cool thing in creation, perhaps, and tell you what I learned? If you please. They were sitting in the loggia over the gatehouse of the caravanserai in which Stephen had left his personal troop of camels, and which was now given up to Captain Aubrey's party. Most of the surprises were to be seen under the shaded arcades that surrounded its central square, reposing after their morning's labour and contemplating the camels, which lay in the full sun not far from their future burdens, the dismantled bell and the many, many boxes of coral, shells and natural wonders collected by Stephen and Martin. Some had adopted members of the tribe of half-wild dogs that roamed the streets of Suez, and Davis was bargaining with the leader of a female Syrian bear for her cub. They all had a pleasant, drowsy, peaceable air. But at the far end there stood pyramids of muskets, piled in the naval manner. And it was perhaps these weapons, as much as Jack's chelenk, that made the Egyptian governor so much more obliging than he had been before. All his own troops had been drawn off for Muhammad Ali's campaign, and although he still mentioned Harbidus, he didn't dwell on the matter, just as his customs officers didn't insist when told that the boxes contained not merchandise but personal property and couldn't be opened. The sherbet came, frosted with the cold, and having drunk a voluptuous pint, Stephen said, "Well, no. It appears that our intelligence was right about the galley's cargo, but mistaken about its time of departure. The Frenchmen were perfectly aware of our general intentions, and even, I suspect, of our specific motions, and they hired a crew of Abyssinian Christians, who rowed it up during Ramadan. But after the Abyssinians had gone home, they kept the vessel going up and down that repulsive channel, and they spread the rumour that more treasure was being moved from one of the southern islands. This so that the tale might reach us. It was hoped that we should take the galley in chase, fully convinced of its value, and that it should lead us into a particularly narrow inlet beyond the batteries, where its crew was to abandon it, and we, having rushed aboard, were to be captured or destroyed. That's why they had so many boats, said Jack. I wondered at the time. He gasped for a while, fanning himself, and then said, Killick caught one of the governor's people trying to open one of the boxes with seals that Mr. Martin begged for his echinoderms. I believe the governor suspects we may have boarded the right galley after all. He was very pressing to be invited aboard. I wonder what the Turks told him. They told him the simple truth. But it's now quite certain that Muhammad Ali is playing a double game with the Sultan, and naturally the Egyptians expect the Turks to do the same by them. Some people here think we took the French treasure, or at least some of it. Some think we took long-sunk treasure from the depths. Some think we took pearls in those waters where they're known to exist, but where no man dares dive. And some think we failed, though I believe every reasoning two-legged creature in the town is convinced that the bell was taken for the purpose of material gain. Where the governor belongs in this array of opinion, I know not, but Hassan warned me not to trust him, Apart from anything else, since an open breach between Muhammad Ali and the Sublime Porte is very probable, he need not fear Turkish resentment if he treats us ill. I shall tell Martin to take particular care of his echinoderms. I will not say a fig for the governor, said Jack. Nor that since he has no troops he has no teeth, because that might be unlucky. But in any case we shall be shot of him tomorrow, and I must say this for him, he's been mighty civil, gathering a good train of camels for us. If I understood him aright, they'll be here at dawn. Then 3 or 4 days later, if we take it easier this time, marching in the morning and evening and resting at midday and night, and if all goes well, we shall be shot of this horrible country too. We shall be aboard that blessed dromedary, sailing down the Mediterranean like Christians. And all I shall have to do will be to write my official letter. God help us, Stephen, I'd rather be flogged round the fleet. Jack Aubrey had always disliked writing official letters, even those in which he had a victory to announce. The prospect of writing one which must speak of total failure in every respect, without the least alleviating feature or favourable circumstance, no chance prize taken, no valuable ally acquired, depressed him extremely. His depression lifted with the appearance of a visitor, however. The Coptic physician Dr. Simaika come to call on Stephen and to talk about European politics, ophthalmia and Lady Hester Stanhope. He brought a basket of fresh cut, and as they chewed it, to find whether in fact it made the heat seem less, he branched off to Egyptian adultery, fornication and pederasty. Sodom itself was only a few days' march east nor east behind the wells of Moses, in their less tragic aspect. And he was so droll, so intensely amused, that although Jack didn't follow a great deal of what he said, and often had to have the point explained, he spent a very pleasant evening, laughing much of the time. Suez seemed a much less revolting place. The changing breeze wafted the stench out to sea. The heat was certainly more bearable. And when the governor's secretary came to say that on second thoughts it might be better if Captain Aubrey were not to start tomorrow after all, he received him with a fine equanimity. Fortunately, Dr. Simaika was still there, and the position was soon clarified. As the governor had been disappointed of even the half platoon of guards he'd been promised, he thought it advisable to send to Tina, so that a body of Turks might return with the messenger, thus providing Captain Aubrey with an escort across the desert. It would only take 10 days or so, and during that time the governor would have the pleasure of Captain Aubrey's much-valued company. God forbid, said Jack. Please to tell him that we know the way perfectly well, that we have no need of an escort, since the men will march with their weapons, and that although nothing would give me deeper satisfaction than sitting with His Excellency, duty calls me away. The secretary asked whether in that case Captain Aubrey would assume full responsibility and hold the governor blameless if, for example, one of his men were bitten by a camel, or if thieves picked his pocket at one of the wells. Oh, yes, said Jack. On my own head be it. Best compliments to His Excellency, and should be happy to keep to our former agreement. Camels at dawn. Shall we ever see them, I wonder? Said Jack, when the secretary had gone. Perhaps you may, said Dr. Simaika, with a very significant look. But before its significance could become explicit, the purser came to ask for instructions about victualling and merit for Captain Aubrey's views on liberty in the technical sense, while at the same time a fight broke out in the square below, a fight between Davis and the bear, which resented his familiarity in chucking it under the chin. The copt bowed and departed. Stephen hurried down to repair the bear, and Jack, having dealt with the question of provisions, said that there was to be no liberty. There was a possibility of their getting underway in the morning, and he didn't choose to spend all day combing the brothels of Suez for stragglers. The one great gate into the caravanserai was to be locked, and Wardle and Pumfret, two misogynistic, puritanical, ill-favoured old quartermasters, the grizzled fathers of 17 children between them, and perfectly reliable when sober, were to guard it. For my part, he added, I must go down and see the last of the Niobe. She sails on the first of the ebb, but I shall turn in very early in case the camels appear. The camels appeared, noisy, smelly, grumbling. And as the great gateway opened, they strode through in the first grey light. And dodging among their legs, bent low to pass unseen, and led by Wardle and Pumfret, came a discreditable number of surprises who'd crept out by night, now pale, hollow-eyed and weary. However, there was nobody missing. Then, after a brief inspection, Mowat could report all present and sober, sir, if you please, without more falsehood than could be borne, since the few hands who were still drunk by naval standards didn't fall until after the inspection. And they were quietly slung onto camels' backs among the tents and seamen's bags. While the few stores that remained from the voyage, a little biscuit, a little tobacco, a quarter keg of rum, and a few barrel hoops that Mr. Adams had saved, he was accountable for every one of them, the seamen's bags, the officers' chests, and Stephen's belongings were being loaded. Killick stripped Jack of all his finery, packed it into his sea chest, and lashed the chest, triple-locked and covered with sailcloth, onto a particularly docile, reliable she-camel led by a black man with an honest face, allowing his captain no more than a pair of old nankeen pantaloons, a linen shirt, a broad-brimmed sailor's hat made of straw, a pair of common ship's pistols, and the shabby sword he used for boarding. These to be hung on the chest when they were out of the town. Yet, plain though he was, Captain Aubrey marched in state, coming first, with Mowat on his right, a midshipman on his left, and his coxswain immediately behind him. Then came the surprises with their officers, forecastlemen in front, then foretopmen, maintopmen and afterguard, and then the baggage train. They left Suez in quite good style, escorted by a cloud of excited yellow curs and little boys. For, although those seamen who started in step soon fell out of it, they did at least keep in recognisable groups until they were well out into the desert. But presently there came a long stretch of heavy-going sand, so soft that, unless a man had feet like a camel, he sank to the ankles. Furthermore, the whole party had been long enough at sea to grow quite unused to walking, and by the time Jack gave the order to halt for breakfast, the column was a long, straggling line. I see that there are some camels with nothing on their backs but drunken sailors and a few tents, said Martin. Army officers generally ride, even in the foot regiments.
So they do in the Navy sometimes, said Stephen. And an eminently comic spectacle it is on occasion. But there is a tedious and, I fear, increasingly powerful sentiment that when something exceptionally arduous and disagreeable is to be done, like walking over a hot, shadowless desert, then all hands must share alike, ton for ton and man for man. It seems to me foolish, inconsistent, ostentatious, useless, illogical. I've often represented to Captain Aubrey that no one expects him to join in cleaning the filth from the ship's heads, nor in many other vile offices, and that it is therefore mere froth and showing away, spiritual pride, nay, downright sin, voluntary to strut about the wilderness like this. And yet, forgive me, Maturin, you are doing so yourself, with camels of your own at hand. That is only moral cowardice. My courage will increase as my ankles swell and my feet grow more blistered, and presently I shall silently mount my beast. We rode, you and I, on the march down. That was because they marched at night, while it was known that we spent the day botanizing.
We were also unperceived. How we botanized! Do you think we shall reach Bir Hafsa tomorrow? Which is Bir Hafsa? The resting place where there was such a fine stretch of Centauri for the camels, and where we found the curious euphorbia among the dunes. And the spiny lizards, the crested desert lark, the anomalous sweet-eared. Perhaps we may. I hope so, indeed. Yet at one time it seemed scarcely possible. The party didn't get along well at all. Those men who had spent the night in song and dance were horribly jaded, and once the sun had climbed a little way, the heat was very great. But there was another factor that hadn't come into play when they marched down the Suez in the darkness. By day, the vast expanse of desert, perfectly level in every direction, offered no shelter for those who wished to relieve themselves. And as several of the surprises, including their captain, were as shamefast and bashful in their actions as they were licentious in their speech, this led to a great loss of time, as men hurried off so that distance, often very great distance, should preserve their modesty. So much was this the case that the party advanced no more than a pitiful stage the first day, only reaching a place called Shuwak, a rocky outcrop with some tamarisk and mimosa scrub less than 16 miles from Suez. But had they gone farther, Stephen would never have been able to show Jack his first Egyptian cobra, a magnificent specimen, 5 feet 9 inches long, that was gliding about the small, ruined caravanserai, with its head raised and its hood expanded, a most impressive sight. Nor would he and Martin have been able to take a camel over to the shores of the Little Bitter Lake, where, in the last rays of light, they saw the pied kingfisher and the hubara bustard. But by the next day most people had recovered. They were now on firm, stony sand, with a certain amount of low vegetation, and they went along at a fine rate. It was the same easy going after the long midday halt, and the sun was still a hand's breadth over the horizon when Bir Hafsa came in sight far ahead. Another ruined building by the side of the track and 3 palms by the well, in a region of fixed dunes. "I think we might as well pitch camp by the well," said Jack. "Going on another hour would be neither here nor there, and we might as well sup in comfort." "You will not object if Martin and I go ahead on our camel?" asked Stephen. "Never in life," said Jack. "And I should be most uncommon obliged if you'd clear the ground of the more disgusting reptiles while you're there." The camel in question, a comparatively good-natured animal with a long, swift stride, soon outpaced the column, even with its double load, and set them down in the Centaurias near the palms with 30 minutes of sunlight to spare. They'd seen 2 very curious wheat-ears, black with white poles, and they were climbing a dune to the east of the camping place to see more when Martin said, "Look, how extremely picturesque." He pointed westwards, and there, on a corresponding dune, black against a brilliant orange sky, Stephen saw a dromedary and its rider. He shaded his eyes against the glare, and down on the level desert he saw more camels, a great many more, and not only camels but horses too. He looked to the south, and there was the column marching in, or rather straggling in, over a furlong of ground, with the baggage train fast catching up as the camels smelt the thorny pasture. "I think we should hurry down," he said. Jack was pointing out the places for the tents when Stephen interrupted him. "I beg your pardon, sir, but there's a large force of camels a short mile to the west. When I last saw them from up there, their riders were changing to horses, which I understand is the Bedouin mode of attack." "Thank you, Doctor," said Jack. "Mr. Holler, pipe to quarters." And raising his voice enormously, "Afterguard! Afterguard there! Double up, double up, double up!" The afterguard doubled up, falling into their place on the 4th side of the square, formed by the forecastleman, the foretopman, and the maintopman. "Mr. Rowan," said Jack. "Take some hands and make the camel drivers take shelter in that enclosure with all their beasts. Killick, my sword and pistols." The square was not military in its neatness, and when Jack said, "Fix bayonets," there was no simultaneous flash, click and stamp. But the sharp blades were there, the muskets were there, and the men were thoroughly used to using them. The square was small, but it was formidable. And as Jack stood there in the middle of it, he thanked God that he'd not tried to increase the rate of march by having the weapons loaded onto the pack animals. He wasn't so pleased when he looked at the slow-moving animals themselves, however. His own chest was on one of the foremost beasts, and Killick was already coming back. But although Rowan and his men had most of the camels in the enclosure, they were still having to beat the stragglers along. And he was just about to call out when he saw horsemen appear on the top of Stephen's dune. He hailed, "Rowan, honey, rejoin at once!" And they came running, their shadows long, on the sand. More horsemen gathered, and then, with a concerted shriek, they raced breakneck down the hill upon Rowan and Honey, easily catching them and cutting them off, enveloping them, but avoiding them by inches as they stood there. After a moment they were past, riding furiously up the opposite slope, where they reined in so hard that their horses stopped dead. Here they poised, for a long moment all armed, either with swords or very long guns. Jack had seen many a fantasia on the Barbary coast. Arabs galloping full tilt at their chief and his guests, firing in the air and turning at the last moment. And as Rowan and Honey came gasping into the square, he said, "Perhaps it's only their fun. No man's to fire unless I give the word." He repeated this with emphasis. And there was a general grunt of agreement, though old Pomfret muttered, "Funny fun." The men looked grave, displeased, but perfectly competent and sure of themselves. Both Calamy and Williamson were nervous, naturally enough, since they had seen almost no action on shore, and Calamy kept fiddling with the lock of his pistol. High on the dune, a red-cloaked man threw up his gun, fired it into the air, and launched his horse down the slope, followed by all the others firing and crying, "Illa, illa, illa!" "It's a fantasia," said Jack, and aloud, "Don't fire!" The troop raced towards them, split in two, and swept round the square, a bewildering whirl and counter-whirl of flying robes, swords flashing in the sunset, guns going off, the unceasing illa, 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 and a great cloud of dust. The sunset, the opaque dust, glowed golden. The ring of galloping horsemen came closer, shouting over the thunder of hooves. Calamy dropped his pistol, which flashed in the pan. Killick sprang from his place as though he'd been wounded, crying, "No, you don't, you black bastard!" And somebody shouted, "They're off!" They were indeed. The last wild round spun away, racing in a straight line westwards, and now it was seen that the camels, too, were fleeing in the same direction, flogged to their uttermost stretch by their drivers. For a few moments they could just be made out in the brief twilight. Then they vanished among the dunes. All the camels but two, one of which had broken its leading rope and was now placidly grazing, while the other lay on the ground, its four legs still clamped together by Killick. He was half buried in the sand and dazed by a variety of blows. He'd been trampled upon, struck and kicked, but he wasn't much the worse. "Oh, I served the bugger out," he said, looking at his bloody fist. Silence fell. The darkness gathered fast. It was over, and no one had been killed or even seriously hurt. But, on the other hand, they'd lost everything except Captain Aubrey's uniforms and decorations, some papers and instruments, and two large tents which were carried by the other beast. "The best thing we can do," said Jack, "is for every man to drink as much as he can hold, and then for us to steer for Tina marching by night again. No one needs food in this heat, and if they do, we can eat the camels. Gather some branches and make a fire by the well. The dry tamarisk flared up, and by its light they saw not what Jack had dreaded, a dry bottom with a long-dead camel in it, but a reasonable body of water. They had no bucket, but Anderson the sailmaker soon whipped one up, using the canvas that covered Jack's sea-chest and the hussif that lay within, and they dipped and filled, until no man could drink again, and even the camels turned away. "Come, we shall do very well," said Jack. "Shall we not, Doctor?"
"I believe we may," said Stephen, "particularly those among us who breathe through their noses to prevent the dispersion of the moist humours, who hold a small pebble in their mouths, and who refrain from pissing and idle chat. The others may fall by the wayside." A deep, strong voice from the dunes came almost immediately after these words. "Hoo-hoo! Hoo-hoo!" It certainly checked all idle chat. But after a pause there was a good deal of low, earnest talking, and presently the boatswain approached Mowat. Then Mowat came to Jack and said, "Sir, the men are wondering whether the chaplain might ask a blessing on our march."
"Certainly," said Jack. "A bidding prayer in times like these is a great deal better. More decent, I mean, than most of your Te Deums. Mr. Martin, sir, would it be in order to hold a short service?"
"Yes, it would," said Martin. He paused for a few moments, recollecting, and then in a plain, unaffected manner he recited part of the litany, and then desired them to join him in the 60th psalm. The singing died away over the starlit desert. The terrors of the night receded. Jack said,
"Now I am quite sure that we shall do very well, that we shall reach Tina and the Turks in fine trim."
They reached Tina. The hill and its fort had been in sight for half a torrid day as they laboured over the last stretch, accompanied by vultures. But they did not reach it in fine trim. The camels were uneaten only because they were needed to carry those whose strength had failed them, either from thirst and hunger, or the extreme heat, or the dysentery they'd caught in Suez. And the poor beasts were so loaded that they could hardly keep up even with the creeping pace of the column, if indeed the mute, parched, wizened band could be called a column and not a dying mob. Nor did they reach the Turks. Very early on, Jack's spyglass had shown him that no colours flew over the fort, and when at last they came near enough, they could all see that the great gate was shut, that there was no movement whatsoever within, and that the Bedouin encampment was gone, leaving an impression of everlasting sterility. Whether the Turks had retired to the Syrian border because of a breach between Egypt and Turkey, or whether they were gone on some military expedition, there was no telling. Nor did Jack greatly care. All his anxiety was concentrated on the dromedary. Was she still there, or had she given them up after so long? Had some storm or some crisis between Turks and Egyptians driven her off? Sunk her? The low mud hills in the sand dunes along the coast hid the nearer part of the bay, and the farther part, where they'd left the ship, was as empty as the desert. The prospect of her not being there, so that they would be left on that fly-blown strand under the murderous sun, was very horrible, and he had to force himself to be calm as he began the last climb. Even so, it was at a scrambling run that he reached the crest. He stood there for a moment, savouring the immense relief that flooded into him, for there she lay, moored head and stern quite close inshore, and her people were scattered all about the bay in boats fishing over the side. He turned
and the sight of his happy face brought the others up at the double, though before a stumbling walk was all that most of them could manage. But they hadn't a hail between them. All they could do was to utter some hoarse, croaking sounds that didn't carry 100 yards. And when they waved, the boats took no notice for a great while, and then only waved back in the calmest, most provoking manner. "Fire a volley," said Jack. For although some men had dropped their muskets in the last intolerable miles, others still had theirs. At the sound of firing, the nearest boat made for the ship, and for a moment it seemed that the dromedaries might have taken fright, might have supposed the Turks and Egyptians were attacking them, or one another, so that it would be better to stand out to sea. But it was only Mr. Allen going back for his telescope. Nothing could more have endeared the dromedaries to the surprises than the cups of tea, the huge quantities of wine and water with lemon juice, and the food they lavished on them. Nothing could have endeared the surprises to the dromedaries more than the appalling time they'd had, their gratitude and the failure of their mission. They sailed westwards as friendly as very old shipmates, all distinction between man-of-war's men and the merchant service gone by the board. And they had remarkably favourable breezes, almost as favourable as those that had brought them up the Mediterranean, and often blessedly cool. Every day Malta came 100 or 150 miles nearer, and every day after the first 2 or 3, Captain Aubrey made an attempt at his official letter. "Listen to this, Stephen, will you?" he said, when they were in longitude 19 degrees 45 minutes east. "Sir, I have the honour to acquaint you that, pursuant to your orders of the 3rd Ultimo, I proceeded to Tina with the party under my command, and from thence to Suez with a Turkish escort, where I embarked in HEI Company's sloop Niobe, and, having eventually taken the Turkish contingent aboard, proceeded in adverse weather to the Mbara Channel, where I made a complete cock of it. Now, the point is, how can I best say that without looking too much of a fool?"